Hello and welcome to Why Football Happens. I'm Ben Jacobs and I'm joined by Stephen Drennan, and we've got a special for the next 20 minutes or so on a highly contentious and seemingly never-ending saga, namely the Newcastle United takeover. A consortium led by PIF, along with Amanda Staveley and the Rubin brothers, tried to buy the club now the best part of 2 years ago, and through a variety of twists and turns have still found themselves unsuccessful. We'll be delving into why, offering insight and trying to work out what is next, which is not an easy question to answer. Stephen, great to have your company. How are you?
Very good. Thanks, Ben. Yourself?
I'm great, thank you. You've looked at the Newcastle takeover from afar. I've cast my opinion and insight on it, having lived and worked in the Middle East and being quite close to both parties. What have you made of it? Looking at this long-running saga, seeing how Newcastle United have been frustrated, watching how the Premier League have shown a lack of transparency, but at the same time, effectively, trying to work out how the Saudi Sovereign Wealth Fund have been able to muscle in the first place and try and buy a football club. There's lots of different components to it.
Yeah, and the other thing you probably know from me as well is I'm very cynical. And it also feels a way for me for Mike Ashley to basically hold on to the club without much competition while this whole legal battle is ongoing. He isn't really being pressured by the fans into doing anything anymore, because the whole pressure is focused on the takeover. So the cynical side of me thinks that's probably an issue. The thing that always was curious for me, Ben, that I'd like you to explain is why it's Newcastle rather than the parties trying to buy the club that are involved, it seems, in this legal battle.
Well, I think that's just the protocol of how it works. So when a consortium reach an agreement with a football club, the football club takes that agreement to the Premier League, and then the owners and directors test takes place, which means that if the owners and directors test is either unsuccessful or, in this case, grinds to a halt, then it still becomes an issue to be resolved between the football club who have brought it to the Premier League and the Premier League themselves. So those are the two primary parties. Of course, it may require input and disclosure and various bits of information back and forth with the consortium. But fundamentally, it's an issue that has to be resolved between the football club, because those taking the deal and wishing to sell from within that football club are still ultimately the incumbents and the Premier League itself. The Premier League would never deal with a third party that hasn't yet gained the necessary green light to take over. Because if they did that, then first of all, you'd require three parties, because the football club itself would still obviously have to be involved. But second of all, they'd have a lot more legwork, because if those wanting to get a foothold into the Premier League could deal directly with the Premier League, then ultimately it would require different relationships, different sets of lawyers, a lot more going on, with lines of communication blurred. So the process is supposed to be streamlined, because the owners and directors test is supposed to ultimately be simple. And I don't want to kind of say it's a box tick, because as it becomes more robust, the whole purpose of it is to stop those that are unwanted or unfit and unqualified to be allowed to come into the Premier League. But most prospective takeovers, after they've reached an agreement and a holding deposit has been paid leading to acquisition, when they then go to the Premier League, would see it as a simple process, would expect to get a green light, and would expect to get that green light within 2 to 3 weeks of taking their prospective takeover to the Premier League to effectively be rubber stamped. So that's what makes the Newcastle takeover so problematic, because it's complicated. It's got all kinds of different backdrops and components that have led to this gridlock. It's got a little bit of politics involved. And it's also got the Premier League, to some extent, sort of scrambling through previous takeovers and making sure that each new takeover becomes more robust. And that's the sort of irony, is that this is a very reactive test, and it always has been. So traditionally, somebody comes into the Premier League and then the Premier League realise maybe we should have safeguarded against that person coming into the Premier League. So when Manchester City's takeover happened, for example, it wasn't this current owners and directors test. It was what was called the fit and proper test in 2008. And since then, it's adapted. So if Manchester City came along now and not in 2008, would they have still passed? That's an interesting question to put out there. And obviously in that gap, if we stay with Manchester City, we've also had Taksin Shinawatra. We've had if we look at Chelsea, Roman Abramovich, you can't set foot inside Stamford Bridge. So it's sort of a shame in some senses that a test perhaps before football became this global and politicised that the Premier League thought was sufficient is now takeover upon takeover being exposed as insufficient. And that's the big gripe with Newcastle United fans. Not so much why haven't the Premier League just approved the takeover, although a lot of people feel that they should have just done and they've dragged their heels. But I think the other gripe is that comparative aspect of you approved it for Burnley and the club is in more debt. You approved it for Crystal Palace and we don't even know who owns them. You approved it for Manchester City and that's a sovereign wealth fund. So I think we've had that twofold gripe of one, why is that test good enough for other takeovers, not Newcastle United? And then two, why have the Premier League not been transparent about why the takeover was not green-lighted?
And I guess the interesting thing as well is I believe that the same people or related family members also own Sheffield United or part thereof, which still isn't entirely clear to me. But is that accurate? And why would they want another club in the Premier League if that's the case?
I mean, it's not hugely accurate because with the royal family in Saudi Arabia, there's so many lines and links that there is extreme distance between the owner of Sheffield United and the owner of Newcastle United, the owner in the sense of the 80% majority of the consortium, the public investment fund that wants to take over the club. So again, it's very easy superficially to say it's just two Saudis, both with royal links, but actually they're very, very different. And the irony is that those trying to say, why can someone with royal links at Sheffield United own a football club and someone with royal links at Newcastle United not own a football club? The sort of paradox of making that argument is Newcastle are trying to maintain the exact opposite, that there's clear separation between the public investment fund and the Saudi Arabian state. And the Saudi Arabian state is, to all intents and purposes, the Saudi Arabian royal family as well. So actually, you don't want to, if you're a Newcastle United fan, be making links back to Mohammed bin Salman, the royal family and the Saudi Arabian government, because the main point that Newcastle United are trying to make is there's a separation. So to all intents and purposes, they're saying that an entity, the public investment fund, who are not influenced by and are separate from the Saudi Arabian government and the Saudi Arabian royal family, are wanting to take over Newcastle United. Then you've got two other consortium members. Then you've got the holding company. Then you've got the football club. So those are the different layers of separation, meaning it would be very difficult for Mohammed bin Salman to influence Newcastle United. The flip side to that is the public investment fund are run by Mohammed bin Salman, the de facto ruler of the Saudi Arabian state. Every single member of the PIF board is a royally decreed appointment. The media minister, and we might come on to piracy in a bit, sits on that board. It's a Dove.gov organization. It's been heavily funded during the pandemic by the Saudi Central Bank, which is the government bank of government funds. So, you know, you can understand in practical terms why the Premier League see a lack of separation and are therefore uncomfortable with the prospective ownership structure, at least unless the levels of influence are clarified to a point where effectively the Saudi Arabian state is tested as part of the process. But if we look at practical reality, that's one argument. If you look at legal reality, that's another. And Newcastle would say, well, forget Sheffield United, forget the royals, forget the Saudi Arabian state. None of this is a factor if we prove separation. And if we prove separation, and they argue legally PIF is its own entity, and if you prove that, then there's no need to look at the bigger picture. There's no need to look at piracy. There's no need to look at politics and human rights. You're testing PIF. They're legally separate to everything else. And when you only test PIF, Newcastle United would argue everyone being put forwards on behalf of PIF should pass the test comfortably.
In terms of this proving, you mentioned earlier about disclosure. One of the things I read was that whenever the Saudis behind this were asked for disclosure of things, they actually pulled the plug and removed the bid. Is that accurate?
I think disclosure has become a hot topic because there's the disclosure around the owners and directors test when it was carried out. And then there is disclosure now regarding the legal cases that are ongoing. So we've got an arbitration case, which has now been postponed until next year. And that is very specifically to determine whether PIF are or aren't separate from the Saudi Arabian state. And there's disclosure issues on both sides there that have led to a gridlock. And as a consequence, the panel have determined that the case has to be adjourned until next year, until that is resolved, or the parties come to a settlement, or ultimately Newcastle United just give up. And that's a really interesting case because you've got both sides saying there's a lack of disclosure. And they're only trying to argue around separation. So what is relevant disclosure and what isn't relevant disclosure is another really important question. Because if you're being that specific with an agreed what's called terms of reference, then some disclosure won't be relevant to that case. But both parties are clearly trying to dig for information, and unfortunately, it's ground to a halt. Then you have a secondary case, which is an anti-competition case, which effectively argues that the Premier League used anti-competitive measures in blocking the takeover, and that is Mike Ashley looking for damages, but also in the process of getting damages over what will probably take 2 years if it runs its full course. The interesting thing about that secondary case and disclosure is that it will play out in public. So the first arbitration has a position that is default of privacy, and then the anti-competition case is the opposite. It has a default position of public. So Newcastle fans would be able to watch that, engage with that, and in the process of gathering information, aspects of disclosure, coming back to your question, would be revealed. And the Premier League, if it runs its full course, wouldn't be able to stop that. So therefore, we may see how transparent the process has actually been. We may see whether one or both parties have withheld information. We'll know a bit more where we stand. We'll know if the government got involved. We'll know if beIN Sports got involved in an untoward manner. And I think everyone would like to see that disclosure because it will give us a bit more of a fuller picture as to what's happened. But it won't necessarily affect the arbitration because arbitration is about that very specific terms of reference. It's about separation. So I think when fans are hoping that the arbitration, which is the quicker case or should be the quicker case, would, through disclosure, reveal something really damning against the conduct of the Premier League, I think that's less likely because the disclosure that would be allowed and the disclosure that would be expected in that arbitration, first of all, would probably stay private between the parties, but second of all, would only be provided in all likelihood, if it was relevant to the terms of reference, whereas the anti-competition case is a lot broader. So there's that kind of disclosure backdrop in the present. And then there's the disclosure around the past. And that's specifically with the owners and directors test. And in simple terms, you have the Premier League, who have argued they asked a series of questions relevant to making a determination as to who to test, i.e. PIF or somebody more than PIF, like the Saudi Arabian state. But, you know, the Saudi Arabian state is very broad, but certainly MBS, because he actually sits on the PIF board. And the Premier League would argue they did not get the disclosure and the information that allowed them to make a clear determination. So they sought legal advice and they used their own judgment to make a provisional conclusion, as they called it, which is they disagreed that only PIF should be tested. And then they invited the consortium to either provide a response to that, provide full information to that, or to challenge that through arbitration, and at which point the consortium withdrew. The flip side to that is the consortium will say the Premier League's offer of arbitration was disingenuous and that they dragged their feet and they gave the consortium no opportunity other than to withdraw. And the consortium have always sort of maintained that they did provide answers. They did provide documentation that showed PIF separation. The Premier League just determined that it either wasn't full enough or they had a predetermined conclusion that they didn't want the takeover to go through. So no disclosure in the world would have got this takeover over the line. So I think you can sort of tell from that answer that what we have is just two polarized sides. And unless we get the transparency to see whether one side is playing games or it's two legitimate points and it's a genuine difference of opinion that needs to be resolved by lawyers, unless we learn more on the transparency side, we're never going to know whether it's mind games on behalf of one or both parties or whether it's just two genuine interpretations that are polarized using the same facts.
Would it be oversimplifying to basically say the group is arguing that you have to test the means of the group And the Premier League is essentially arguing that that doesn't actually matter. It's who controls the group, and that's who needs to be tested, the individuals behind it.
No, I think that's a good way of looking at it. I think that there's other components at play here. So I think that the consortium are simply arguing, we're PIF, we're a legally separate entity. We've done business with Uber and SoftBank. We've invested in other sports before, most notably Formula One back on Saudi Arabian soil. We've brought boxing to Saudi Arabia. What's the problem? We're a global business entity with a Saudi Arabian angle. And if our structure is good enough for all the other deals that we've done, of which there's thousands, then why isn't it good enough for Newcastle United? And then I think the Premier League are saying, well, our test has to safeguard against undue state influence. And in addition to that, we believe, and here's the key point, and Newcastle fans will probably listen to this and say, well, why have they got the right to believe this? But the Premier League's starting belief is ultimately that they are selling a football club to Newcastle United, selling in the sense of approving a takeover. They're obviously not directly involved in the negotiations, but the Premier League's take is basically they're greenlighting a takeover and therefore inducting someone into their league. And that same someone, PIF, is also behind the stealing of their rights. And that's the big kind of gripe here, that the backdrop to all of this is ultimately the Premier League believe firmly, through their own research and evidence and attempted court cases, that the Saudi Arabian state were directly behind the pirate network called BLQ. And they directly supported the theft of Premier League rights, and they directly supported essentially kicking out the legitimate broadcaster BN Sports from Saudi Arabia. And then shortly after that, they come back in the form of PIF and say, we want to buy a football club. And ultimately, the Premier League's take is, why should we rubber stamp a takeover to the same people that we firmly believe stole our rights? Or if we are going to do that, first, we want to see proof that you didn't steal our rights. And here's where it gets really complicated, because if we're coming back to the court case, and if the Premier League believe that PIF is the Saudi Arabian state, and if the Premier League also believe that the Saudi Arabian state stole their rights in the most advanced pirate network ever founded, then can the Premier League ask for information pertaining to BLQ and piracy to be satisfied that the Saudi Arabian state didn't have a role and that PIF didn't have a role? Or is that not relevant disclosure? And that's the big question mark. You know, are Newcastle United well aware of these links and basically trying to make clever legal arguments to get around it because they want their takeover, but deep down they know that the Premier League have a legitimate point? Or are the Premier League fishing to resolve an issue of piracy that shouldn't pertain to PIF and this takeover, and that's what's frustrated Newcastle United? And again, that's what's polarized social media throughout all of this. And of course, human rights, it'd be great for the Premier League to stand up for them. It would be admirable. It would be bold. It would be wonderful. It would be moral. But we see so often in sport and with sports washing, organizations shirk on getting involved on issues that do not directly pertain to them. But piracy directly pertains to the Premier League, and piracy has resulted in BN Sports, the host broadcaster in the Middle East and North Africa, being angry. And given that they fund the Premier League and do so to the tune of 500 million, and it's their largest international market, and that money filters back to all of the clubs, including Newcastle United, the Premier League as an individual entity and the Premier League collaboratively working on behalf of a key broadcast partner obviously have a vested interest in all of this. So I can understand why the Premier League would want piracy to be resolved before committing to doing the testing and approving a takeover, especially because the media minister also sits on the PIF board, and he's the Premier League's main point of contact for resolving the issue of piracy. So there's sort of that aspect of dealing with piracy, even though BLQ no longer exists, and there's that aspect of honesty. Do we really want to get into bed and allow someone into our league if we think they're linked to PIF, and in addition to that, we think that they brazenly stole our rights? So I understand that perspective, but I also understand the Newcastle United perspective of these issues are all not relevant to the takeover that we've got on the table. And that's pretty much one for the lawyers to decide in terms of how we move forwards with this.
Is this not just maybe a problem overall with having owners that just simply have too much power in the actual world? Like, if you look at the politics between Saudi Arabia and America and the whole Khashoggi murder and the fact that there was accusations that basically Donald Trump was a puppet of Saudi Arabia, but whether they're true or false, it just gives you an indication of how much power they have. And then on the other hand, you have a regulating body for a football team in England. And how would they ever have the power to control or get information from Saudi Arabia that they didn't want to have? Because ultimately, if Saudi Arabia want plausible deniability on the parroting or whatever else, they're going to have it because they'll have like a whole network, the equivalent of England's MI5, for example, to basically create layers upon layers of separation, whereby you'll never be able to trace it back to them if they were behind it. So it just becomes pointless.
Yeah, I think so. But I think that Saudi Arabia were quite naive because BLQ, as the name suggests, because the Q stands for Qatar, was born out of a blockade where Saudi Arabia, at the time the blockade started, didn't want to air be in sports, but wanted sports. So they picked and choose what sport they wanted. They ripped it off. They marketed it as an advanced pirate network. And then when they realized they could do it, they started taking from the BBC and ESPN. And I don't think that they foresaw the consequences. So regardless of the Newcastle United takeover and its repercussions on that, I don't think they saw the longer term consequences. So when this was all being investigated, there was some sort of plausible deniability. And the first Saudi Arabian response, even though it was clear that the channel aired in Saudi Arabia, was that it had come from Cuba and Colombia and it was rogue and they knew nothing about it. But they didn't actually do that good a job at covering it up because they probably didn't foresee the consequences, because they perhaps thought that, you know, when you steal something in Saudi Arabia, market it in Saudi Arabia, that ability to investigate is going to be very limited. And that was certainly the case with the Premier League. So I think a lot of Newcastle fans feel like beIN Sports has led an attack against Saudi Arabia on this issue. And the Premier League have jumped on the bandwagon because of how powerful they currently are within the Premier League. But the Premier League individually went to Saudi Arabia 7 times to try and take their own independent civil action to get the bottom of BLQ, stacked up with a load of evidence that needed hearing in an impartial court, and no legal firm would take the case against the Saudi Arabian government. So no progress has unfortunately been made because the case has to be heard in Saudi Arabia, because that's ultimately where the damage was done. So if you want damages in a civil action case, it's got to be heard in Saudi Arabia. But, you know, it's not correct to say that there isn't evidence against the Saudi Arabian government. There is stacks of evidence against the Saudi Arabian government. There's whistleblowers that worked in the Riyadh and Dammam call centers that have explained how it worked and have confirmed an HQ in Saudi Arabia. There is frequency analysis from a pan-MENA organization called Arabsat that shows the BLQ broadcasts came through the Arabsat frequencies, and Arabsat in Saudi Arabia is controlled by the Saudi Arabian government, which means that once you know it's on their frequency, and you don't just get something on a government frequency. So once it's there, the government may say we didn't found it and they may say we didn't fund it, but they absolutely can't say they didn't know about it and they didn't take it down, which means that they were supporting it come what may. So then the question is just to what degree. Shortly before BLQ appeared, Saudi Arabia, through their government, said they were launching their own sports channel called PBS Sport along with Egypt. And then within weeks, a massive launch with 15 channels as a rival to beIN Sports. So right at the beginning of the blockade, that just disappeared. And that was a channel that had Xavi and Maradona as guests on it, the late Maradona, obviously, when he was still with us. And it just disappeared. And then a few weeks later, BRQ came around, seemingly as a replacement to it, a cheaper replacement that didn't require the same costs, that didn't require the same legalities, that didn't require the same rights purchases. And I think basically the Saudi Arabian government just realized there was no point in starting a mass scale legal sports channel because you still needed to buy the rights. And there weren't that many of them available, and it was going to cost them money. So they'd be launching something that wasn't able to replace BN Sports, not in the short term, whereas BLQ could replace BN Sports overnight because they literally just slapped a new logo on a BN Sports feed and then went with it. And then there's other bits of proof. For example, the hosting for the online version of BLQ was paid for by a Dr. Kushim, who is the founder of Cellavision, the most prominent Saudi media company with an HQ in Saudi Arabia and then another office in Dubai. So somehow and stupidly, to buy the hosting rights to allow you to effectively have online, in really simple terms, what you're broadcasting through your sat network, to host that, you pay a monthly fee to an IT company, which is based in America in this case, and then they'll put it online for you. And this guy, Dr. Kushim, the head of Cellavision, used his own credit card to purchase that every month. And that's what I mean about the stupidity of not realizing how big this would be, not realizing that they needed to cover their tracks more. So there's loads of evidence. The Premier League have done frequency analysis. There's a report called Mark Monitor. There's the evidence that went to the WTO. There's the evidence that went to the EU Commission. There's stacks of evidence all pointing back to Saudi Arabia. And yet Saudi Arabia said, oh, it was Cuba and Colombia. And then when that was denied, they changed their tune again. And every time a bit of evidence has come that points it back to the Saudi Arabian government, either funding it, founding it, supporting it, or in a best case scenario, turning a blind eye, they've never been able to give answers with any kind of clarity to rebuff the evidence against them. What they've clung to is just the fact that it's almost impossible to get into Saudi Arabia and try this. So then you go in and you buy Newcastle and you muscle in and you start a legal sports channel. It's a classic example of sports washing. They're hoping that people forget about what they've done and are glad for the new investment and are glad for the fact they're now clamping down on IP and are glad for the fact that they're looking to work productively and legally with organizations like the Premier League. So the Premier League, if they are causing friction because of piracy, are showing some real stones, because it would be very easy for them to just say, fine, let's brush it under the carpet, let's have a productive working relationship, and let's let everyone gladly accept the money that's on the table. It's win-win-win. But it's not win-win-win morally, and it's not win-win-win in terms of the honesty aspect of things, because I personally wouldn't want to do a deal with somebody I knew only months or years before stole from me. And that's the big sticking point.
You mentioned BN a bunch of times there, and I'm guessing they're probably the media company that lost the most out of this. And they're also owned by the same person that owns Paris Saint-Germain. And is this just is this a political thing between Qatar and Saudi Arabia that's spilling over into sport? Is it one billionaire not wanting another bigger billionaire in his paddling pool stealing his toys, or is there something behind this that everyone's not quite seeing, or is it basically just the Premier League not wanting someone who has shadiness and they're not being quite truthful and forthright with what they're being asked?
Well, I think, first of all, like the Newcastle fans would say, once you determine to turn one person away for, in inverted commas, as you put it, shadiness, then what about all the rest? And that's where I think there's the biggest gripe from fans watching from the outside in, that how is it okay for Nasser Al Khelaifi to work so closely with UEFA, to buy all these rights for BeIN, to bring Messi to PSG, despite shortcomings with financial fair play. Nasser himself had a trial within the last 6 months as well around bribery for television rights and giving a villa to Jerome Valka. And I think that Newcastle fans will say, well, how's he getting away with it, in inverted commas? Of course, that is just an allegation. And his particular case has gone through the legal courts and he was vindicated. But of course, fans say, well, of course he was vindicated because he's part of the club, whereas PIF are not part of the club. But again, I hate the argument when someone says, just because one person did something wrong, another person should be able to do something wrong and be held to the same standards. So
if you make that argument,
you should be trying to kick out Nasser Al-Khelaifi, not welcome in PIF, because we're trying to clean up football, not consistently dirten football, if you see what I mean. But I think the first part of what you say is true, that there is a backdrop. Obviously, the whole thing has been politicised, but the blockade, to some extent anyway, ended or eased in January of this year. And the airspace opened between Qatar and Saudi Arabia and relations improved. So I think at that point, people thought that all this might go away slowly because of the political backdrop. It's obvious that beIN Sports got caught in the politics and Saudi Arabia didn't want their sports channel. And even though they're separate now from Al Jazeera, everyone basically thinks beIN is Al Jazeera and Al Jazeera is the Qatari emir. So as a consequence, you do have a very direct and politicized backdrop that has caused the friction. And it caused beIN's license to be suspended from Saudi Arabia. And it caused Saudi Arabia to not want to air beIN Sports during the course of the blockade. And then, yeah, beIN got damaged by that because the biggest market in the Middle East and North Africa for anybody is Saudi Arabia. So once beIN can't legally sell their product in Saudi Arabia and market their product in Saudi Arabia, what they've done is paid $500 million for a set of sports rights, and they will know that a large take-back, probably somewhere to the tune of 20 to 25% of the income that they are going to pull back in, is going to come from a Saudi Arabian market. It's probably about 12% of their total income back through subscription, and then another 10 to 12% through advertising that they can glean and procure from that region. So if you remove Saudi Arabia from the mix, then it's a big, big hit for beIN Sports because they've paid for Saudi Arabia. They can't air in Saudi Arabia, whether rightly or wrongly, because Saudi Arabia will make arguments as to why beIN's license was removed. And they say it predates the blockade and it's down to what they call bundling, which again, in really basic terms, is false advertising. But nonetheless, they on the Saudi Arabian side will have their own arguments and it's not kind of worth going into all the specifics. But fundamentally, beIN have lost the most from this because they've lost their biggest market, and they've lost their biggest market during the course of the blockade. And even now the blockade is eased beyond that. And that's why that has to be resolved. And also the Premier League will be acutely aware that if you've got Sheffield United owned by Saudi Arabia and Sheffield United can come back into the Premier League potentially, and then you've got Newcastle United, if they're owned predominantly by PIF in Saudi Arabia, you've got a very dangerous situation where you've got two football clubs that both could be in the Premier League and you've got no legal way to watch the Premier League in Saudi Arabia. So the Premier League, I think, want the piracy situation resolved in terms of honesty about who was behind it and a resolution. But even if you take that out of the equation, the Premier League will also just want, even if we still don't know about BLQ and a resolution, the Premier League will still want to know categorically that beIN are allowed back inside Saudi Arabia. So if the Newcastle United takeover happens, they can say it's legal to watch our brand. Otherwise, if the Newcastle takeover happens first and it's illegal to watch the Premier League in Saudi Arabia, then there's a real danger that the pirate network or an equivalent of it will come back very quickly. Because guess what? If PIF own Newcastle United, especially if Newcastle United do well and do well quickly, then you can bet your bottom dollar that Saudi Arabia are going to want to watch Newcastle week in, week out. So it's sort of a strange dichotomy. And even though PIF and Mike Ashley and the Premier League clearly don't agree on everything, I feel a bit sorry for PIF because you've got Ashley fighting a bullish war because he wants his money and he wants his relationship in the Middle East and he wants to get out and he wants to sell for a high price. And because of the pandemic, no one else is going to put this offer that PIF have put on the table. And then you've got the Premier League who want everything kept private and haven't had a good relationship with Mike Ashley, but probably haven't had that much to do with PIF. And then you've got PIF who are sort of silently waiting in the wings, not really wanting to cause a media stir, not wanting to comment, happy to buy the club if the opportunity arises, but probably wanting more clarity than most. Like, they don't want a long-running legal battle, but Mike Ashley might if the end goal for him is more money. But PIF really just want no bad PR because they have to have a working relationship with the Premier League, as do the Rubin brothers and Amanda Staveley. So they're not really looking to jump as bullishly into this fight as Mike Ashley. They're looking to have a layer of separation. So then if Newcastle get them over the line, they can come in and sort of not have that acrimony or animosity that unfortunately has dogged the takeover for the best part of 18 months. They're going to want to come in and just say, we've waited patiently, we're excited to be here, we're going to invest in Newcastle, we're going to invest in the community, we're going to promote Saudi Arabia, and we're going to have a positive working relationship with the Premier League. And if they can't get to that point, they won't return to the table and the takeover will never happen.
Just one last question. A lot of it I've seen from the Newcastle fans is basically framed as this will definitely be a positive thing for our club. But there are some small voices out there that are basically saying things like, what if we become like Hull and we lose our identity and they want to change maybe even where we are, or they want to rebrand the club, or if they become like Notts County with Munto Finance and it all turns out the PIF not really actually being as stable as they say, or Dnipro in Russia where the owner basically got bored when he couldn't compete anymore and just emptied the club. Is there any danger at all that something like that could happen to Newcastle and this could turn out to be the worst thing that they wished for?
I think there is a definite possibility of that. And I think Newcastle United fans have been warned, because the previous takeover that was right on the cusp of going through was from the Bin Zayed group, also from the Middle East and North Africa. And they announced publicly that they were going to buy the club and that it was essentially a done deal, and it turned out that it wasn't. And Mike Ashley got really annoyed by them going public and being so confident about it. And we've since learned that they've not paid any of their legal bills to do their due diligence on Newcastle. And as you may well know, they then went to Derby County and they said that was a done deal. And then they never ended up taking over Derby County either. And look at what a mess Derby are in, because they've been waiting in limbo with a load of pandemic debt. And Derby County could well go down this season, and they were very fortunate not to go down last season. And then with PIF, I think that the danger is more on identity than stability, because I think it would be a big investment and a very strategic investment. And I think the running of the club would actually be very organized. And one of the first things, if the consortium is successful, that they should do is share the tenets of the business plan, because there's a lot of rumour out there about the level of investment. And the first task for effectively Yasser Al-Rumi and the proposed chairman, but the consortium at large, is to be the anti-Mike Ashley. And, you know, there is an irony about Ashley at the moment asking for transparency when he's been the least transparent owner on the planet for his tenure at Newcastle United Football Club. And PIF haven't said anything, and they've not been that transparent either. So if they come in, the first thing they have to do once they're in power at the football club is be transparent about their business plan, be transparent about what they plan to do with the community, be transparent about how they plan to get the football team into European qualification and beyond, and be very transparent about where they fit in their broader, what's called Vision 2030 goals. So anything PIF touches has to fit with Vision 2030. And Vision 2030 effectively is about improving the quality of life for the Saudi Arabian public. And at the same time, it's about making sure that Saudi Arabia is sustainable beyond just oil going forward. So you invest in something that isn't oil centric, and then you commercialize it and make money from it. And then you invest back into Saudi Arabian society. So when you put it like that, buying a football club doesn't fit that mold, unless you're going to kind of manage it really stringently like Arsenal and make sure that there's a positive turnover every single year. So therefore, if a fan thinks that they're just going to come in and throw billions and billions and billions and loss lead, albeit within the remit of financial fair play, they're a bit misguided, because PIF are a serious business with serious financial goals. This isn't a vanity project. And if therefore they fail to commercialize Newcastle United, or the success they're hoping for doesn't come quickly, there is always a little bit of a danger that they might lose a little bit of interest and patience. But I think what reassures Newcastle United fans is that this isn't just an unknown ownership group. This is a global organization that are very savvy at investments, but they're also flagged by Amanda Staveley, who knows Newcastle through and through, and the Rubin brothers, who also have a huge volume of capital they could invest and have already invested into the Newcastle United society. So you've got a good blend of, if you like, Newcastle experts, business experts, and financial muscle. So I don't think that there's a risk of Saudi Arabia losing interest. And I don't think there's a risk of Newcastle United becoming a financial woe tale. And I don't think there's an interest of the money that the group says is there not being there, which was definitely the case with BZG. The Bin Zayed group were talking openly to journalists, including myself, and saying they had money, but it turns out that they didn't. And it was all based upon, we'll buy the football club and then we'll lure in the money we need afterwards by going out and selling in the market. Whereas PIF have clearly got the capital there. I mean, they were given trillions during the pandemic to invest from the Saudi Central Bank, and that money is going to be used on Newcastle United in part. But the risk is on identity. The risk is that Newcastle United lose that look and feel of kind of, you know, a northern club that play with a smile, that have the most incredible fans, that have the most unique fans. You know, when you go to St. James's Park at the moment, that experience of the city, of the hospitality, of the away end that's practically up in the heavens, of the kind of banter, of the slang, of the Geordie talk, you know, everything about Newcastle puts a smile on the face. It's always had iconic colours, iconic fans. You think of the entertaining style they played under Kevin Keegan. You think of the relationship between the fans, the ownership group, and the football club before Mike Ashley. And that's what they want back. So then if a group comes in and says, we're putting Visit Saudi on your shirts, we want the away kit to change from the sort of turquoisey colour that it's been for the last few seasons to more of like a bottle Saudi green. We want a Saudi flag somewhere on the crest. I'm not, by the way, saying that that's going to happen, but I'm giving you an extreme example. We want to take the football club over to Saudi Arabia to play a competitive fixture. We want to join the European Super League. I know it's defunct, but there was absolutely categorically Saudi Arabian funding behind JP Morgan's masked kind of united front of bringing the Super League to fruition. So you can bet your bottom dollar, even though they didn't say it at the time, and even though they played into the outrage narrative, that if Newcastle United were taken over by PIF and the European Super League had happened, you can bet your bottom dollar that Newcastle United would have been all over that. And again, that's about a lack of clarity as to what they're going to do with the brand building. So some of the brand building's great, you know, foreign ownership that want to embrace Newcastle, foreign ownership that want to take the tenets of Vision 2030 and translate them to Newcastle. That's all brilliant. So if they inverse Vision 2030 and make it about the football club succeeding, but also Newcastle society improving, more jobs, better quality of life, much needed money during a pandemic, then brilliant. And if they're transparent about that, they'll be an excellent investor for Newcastle United, even if the backdrop around should they or shouldn't have they invested is still up for debate. If they get over that, they'll be brilliant for Newcastle United. Every other fan will go, ugh, you know, it's sports washing and why have we ignored the politics and the human rights and the piracy? Mm-hmm. But if they get over that, it'll be brilliant for Newcastle. But the question is going to be if they have the opportunity, as per the European Super League model, to kind of franchise Newcastle, if they have the opportunity to move Newcastle away from what Newcastle fans expect, if they want to change the colours, if they want to play competitive games abroad, if they use that muscle to basically redefine the goalposts of what a football club in the Premier League should stand for, that's worrying. And of course, fans listening to me now will say, but you're just rambling and that it's not happened to Man City and it's not happened to other football clubs with foreign owners. And yeah, to some extent, that's true. But football is heading in that direction. The more powerful the City group gets, the more clubs it takes on, the more sway they're going to have. And, you know, if eventually the City club in a hypothetical had 50 clubs in 50 countries, of which 10 of them were world superpowers on different continents and in different leagues, then eventually you wouldn't need a European Super League. The City group could just break away and do its own thing because it would have 50 franchises that it could put in two different tiers. So I'm not saying that's in the strategy, and a lot of these leagues are still very powerful. But obviously the leagues are guarded against that. And, you know, let's just give you another hypothetical to finish with. If PIF didn't choose Newcastle, if PIF tomorrow decided they wanted Celtic, there's absolutely no way they're just going to keep Celtic in the Scottish Premier League. If they think they can get Celtic, it's because they think that they can move Celtic into the Premier League, or they can move Celtic into La Liga or whatever. And, you know, that's the worry, is if you can't get the biggest club in the world, or it's not value to get the biggest club in the world and buy into a brand that already exists. And it's harder to buy into a brand that already exists because that brand is going to be less flexible. It's not going to want to alter dramatically, and it's going to know its own worth, which is why those brands are worth millions and millions more than Newcastle United. Mm. And that's Man United, that's Real Madrid, that's Barcelona, and so on. So what you're looking for is a brand, to some extent, when you look for value, that you can shape, and you can shape it because maybe it owns its own stadium that you can develop, or maybe because there's space around the stadium to build other things, or maybe you can build them a new training facility, or maybe you're buying them for price A and you know they'll be worth price B when your investment translates into European success. And at that point, if it's the first real flurry of recent modern European success, you've already changed the narrative and changed the brand. And then if you want to change the colours, change the name, change the location, change the stadium, change the style, change the ethos, you can sort of do that because the fan base are on board, because you're targeting towards, one, a generation that just wants success, but two, a global generation. So, you know, if you're marketing in Saudi Arabia and playing in Saudi Arabia, or marketing towards Saudi Arabian tourism, and then suddenly 5,000 people buy season tickets from Saudi Arabia, that becomes part of your brand. And then you've sold out your stadium, and that is the new Newcastle audience. It doesn't matter whether they come every week, if they hold those season tickets, pay for those season tickets, buy the hospitality and so on. You effectively overnight don't have to worry about a backlash because you've got in a whole new bunch of fans. So I suppose, even though this is a very long answer to your question, I suppose the most striking example of that is PSG. So PSG, give or take, had 20 million followers on social media. They signed Messi, and 5 hours later, they had 40 million followers on social media.
Wow.
And if you look at those 40 million followers, then if 20 million of them can be assessed and commercialized, then a huge proportion of those 20 million are still going to be passive Messi fans that just want to buy a Messi PSG shirt. But there'll probably be 10,000 of those 20 million that are prepared to buy a PSG season ticket. There'll probably be 50,000 of them that plan on seeing more than five games a season. There'll probably be 1 million of them that are quite happy to come and see Messi once at the Parc des Princes. And there'll probably be 5 million of them that have got a huge interest in the Champions League run that PSG go on. So then if you've literally doubled your fans, the outrage of the older school ones that hate every moment of it or can't get a season ticket because it's gone to a Messi fan that's just rich and hangs on to it and is fair weather and doesn't come that often. The vocal fan base that was your core are almost diluted and minimized because you've added so many. And I think that's the same with Newcastle, that it won't be to the same degree as Messi. But as I said before, you know, if Newcastle end up in the Champions League and owned by Saudi Arabia, they'll add 20,000 fans from Saudi Arabia, of which there'll probably be 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 that are rich enough that just want to buy a season ticket, and they'll get a season ticket. And then, you know, 6,000 in a stadium that holds 50,000 is quite a big percentage that makes you feel like, as a brand, you've got that buy-in. So it'll be interesting to see how it develops, but that's a really intriguing aspect. So the short answer to your question, in a very, very long answer at my end, is that there's no risk to Newcastle in terms of the lack of interest or the damage to the football club on the field, but there's a huge, huge risk to the brand identity that is currently affiliated to the football club.
That's a fantastic answer, Ben. And thanks for answering all my questions. I feel like I'm starting to understand a little bit the most muddy, protracted ownership battle I've probably seen in my lifetime.
It's very complicated, isn't it? And I always get asked about this, and it's very difficult to condense into short answers because of the complexity. And the fact there is that complexity it shows you why all parties have struggled to get a resolution. I think from the outside in, it's very easy to say, well, Newcastle agreed a deal. They want their takeover. They're trying to be as transparent as they possibly can. Why hasn't it been done? But it's far more complex than that, with far more issues on both sides. And yet the Premier League haven't been transparent, but it is ultimately a business transaction and arbitration does have a default position of privacy. But Newcastle are not right to say they've got nothing to hide either. Both sides have failed to provide disclosure. Both sides are at fault on the transparency front. And then it's just a case of trying to determine, one, what's happened, two, what legitimately should be out in the public domain, and most importantly, three, how are we going to get clarity on this? Because if we don't get clarity on this, so it'd be great for the Newcastle fans that want a takeover if they could just get a takeover. But by the same token, if it isn't going to happen, now is the time for the parties to openly and honestly stop racking up legal bills and stop fostering false hope. So again, if it isn't false hope, PIF or the consortium must come out and say that overtly and give a proper timescale and as much detail as they can. And now would be the time for PIF to make a statement and say they're still hoping to take over the football club. Because the irony of it all is, if arbitration, which is the quickest route to getting a takeover, because if arbitration proves that PIF are not separate, then PIF are going to walk away. But if arbitration proves that PIF are separate, they'll return to the table and they'll pass the test because the Premier League won't be able to factor in these outside issues. But it's all irrelevant debating in arbitration for the best part of a year if PIF are or are not separate from the Saudi Arabian state. If at the end of the process, PIF are like, sorry, we've lost interest, or we've bought into Milan. So they need to make a statement. There needs to be transparency as to whether or not the parties are still genuinely at the table, because otherwise everything we learn is fostering false hope and toxicity amongst fans. And then, as I say, the second thing is just, if it's over, everyone involved has a duty to now tell Newcastle United fans it's over. So it's that clarity. So sure, Newcastle fans would love a takeover, but if they're not going to get a takeover, they'd much rather be put out of their misery now and told they're still with Mike Ashley. And then that then forces Mike Ashley to not leave the football club in limbo and actively try and sell to someone else or invest in his football club to make sure that they don't get in a relegation battle. And obviously the clarity over this takeover is 100% not going to happen would force Mike Ashley to turn his attention and passion back into the football club. And if Mike Ashley invested even a shred of the same passion and commitment into his football club this season as he has done to try and get this takeover complete, then Newcastle United would comfortably be avoiding relegation this season. And there'd be clarity over whether Steve Bruce is going to stay, and there'd be a bit of spending power, and there'd be a little bit of a feel-good factor, even though the fans don't like Ashley. But the challenge is just that lack of clarity. So, of course, if it's clarity and it's negative, it's not ideal for Newcastle United fans, but much better, you know, it's not going to happen than you just get misled for another 6 months and then it still doesn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like it's been going on forever.
But I think we'll leave it there. And good catching up, Stephen. And obviously, likewise, the whole point of this is that we'll be able to turn the tables at some point, and I'll be able to ask the questions and you'll be able to give me the long rambly answers with insight about a topic that's dear to you. But for now, I think we'll wrap things up. So that's been our special, Why Football Happens, on the Newcastle United takeover. I hope we've given you a bit of insight. I hope we've given you a perspective that perhaps you haven't considered before. And we've given you a layer of detail that helps you understand the story better. Do tweet us with your comments and reach out if you have any further questions, and we'll try and answer them online. But for now, from Stephen and myself, Ben Jacobs, it's goodbye.
And that place to get in contact with us is at @WFH_podcast. That's at @WFH_podcast on Twitter. And of course, don't forget to rate, review, like, and subscribe to the podcast on anchor.fm, our host, and all good podcasting outlets as well, to stay up to date with everything we do throughout the season here at Why Football Happens. The season has just got going, as have we in the podcasting world. We'll be back with more football discussion next time.